Hello, film and music fans. Edith here. Welcome along to another episode of Soundtrackin'. Thank you very much indeed for choosing to listen to us. We know there is a wealth of listening opportunities out there, so we really appreciate that you are choosing to listen to us, whether you be a regular listener to the show or whether you be a first-time listener. It is lovely to have you along for the ride. Today, or this week's show, is it's a pretty special one, to be honest. It's our fifth birthday. Woohoo! Happy birthday to us. I mean, the fact that we are celebrating 5 years, I'm absolutely blown away by, because this podcast started 5 years ago with Ben and I, who still works on the show. Thank the Lord. Thank you, Ben. It started because we wanted to have a conversation and celebrate the relationship, the very wonderful and brilliant relationship that music has with film, and kind of look into how that relationship is so unique to each project. And I feel that we do that every week, and every week is different because we obviously speak to a different person every week. But the conversation ranges from being quite intense and really getting into the nitty-gritty of things with certain guests, and sometimes it can be a bit more kind of conversational around film and music. So I feel and I hope that we really provide an insight for all different levels of film fans, but across all of it, I really hope that you learn something from it, and more importantly, you enjoy listening to it, because I can't tell you how much joy I get from making it. This really is my pride and joy when it comes to my work. I love making this show. I really hope that we can continue making this show for many years to come. And I am hugely indebted to Mr. Ben Backhouse, who works on the show with me. And I know he'll be editing this and listening to this as I say it, and has no idea that I'm saying this. But Ben, thank you so much for the last 5 years and for your amazing work. I really couldn't have done this without you, and I hope I continue to be able to do this with you. So thank you so much for all your amazing work over the last 5 years. And this podcast is as much yours as it is mine, and it's down to Ben the way that it sounds. So I love listening to it because I do the interviews and I send the audio to Ben, and he does his wizardry on it and adds all those beautiful colours and textures to the interviews to make them, to bring them to life and to make them really reference all those brilliant pieces of music so well. So Ben, thank you so much. So then, to celebrate our fifth birthday, we thought that we'd go back to where it all began by speaking to the one and only Mr. Ben Wheatley, who appeared on our very first episode of Soundtrackin' and joins us for his fifth sitting for our fifth birthday. So it feels perfect. And Ben is joined by his longtime producer, Andy Stark, to discuss his film In the Earth, which was made during lockdown with all the difficulties that that brought. Now, set during a deadly global pandemic, In the Earth tells the story of a scientist and a park scout who embark on a mission to find a renegade botanist conducting research into plant life deep in the woods. Much hallucinogenic mayhem ensues, referencing everything from Hammer Horror to Hansel and Gretel and Doctor Who, not to mention Ben's previous work. In the Earth is scored by our very good friend, hugely talented Clint Mansell, and it's with his title track from the movie that we begin. Thank you.
How you doing?
Hi. Thanks for your time.
No worries.
Thanks for doing it.
Listen, it's I feel like, Ben, you're like our lucky mascot, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm sure you can see how lucky I am by looking at the listening figures for each of the ones I'm on.
Top 10, actually, of all time. So I think you'll find, yeah. But it's 5 years in August since we started the podcast, and you were our very first episode. So eternally grateful, mate. Eternally grateful. Listen, I had the most amazing experience watching your film in the cinema at Picture House Central the other night.
Cool.
Oh, it was so good. Oh, you know when you want to go into it, and I had deliberately, because you'd mentioned it when we spoke last October about it. You were, I've already filmed this other film. I'm like, what? How? What? And he's like, not telling you anything. It's horror. So I deliberately tried to kind of, you know, I'm not listening to anybody saying anything about it in social media and whatnot, because I just wanted to go in and experience it. And it was so many things. You know when like babies sometimes like burp, fart, giggle, and like do all that at once, like an explosion of things. I kind of like, not that I kind of did all that kind of thing.
It's too much information, really.
Sorry, though, yeah. So yeah. I mean, I know this is the fifth time you've been on the podcast, but maybe that's too familiar. But just the idea of the unexpected, and there's obviously knowing you as a filmmaker and a storyteller and how brilliant and real you can step into worlds. But I just thought it was so great. So congratulations.
Oh, cheers. Well, thanks for going and seeing it at the cinema.
I love going to the cinema on my own. There's something absolutely liberating about going to the cinema on your own.
We hadn't seen it finished on a big screen until about 2 weeks ago.
No.
We saw it obviously when we did the sound mix. It was on a big screen when you mix, but we'd never seen it actually finished on a DCP in a cinema until Ben did the tour last couple of weeks ago.
What was that like for you then?
It was very different.
Yeah, well, it had been released in America already, and we still hadn't seen it, you know, and it was odd.
Because Sundance was just a virtual festival, obviously, you know, so it was, you know, I just think it's just a totally different experience, isn't it? Obviously, it really is, and that's the whole point, you know, of concentrating for an hour and a half in a dark room on something is such a wonderful sort of, it's like a privilege now, isn't it?
Yeah. Andy, we do feel privileged that you've joined us as well, because we've been trying to get you on here for years, quite frankly. So I'm glad that you finally came and joined Ben for this one as well, because you've got this relationship, you know, and really successful relationship of, in terms of facilitating each other's kind of creative needs and wants, you know, in terms of the world of film sort of thing. And I just was really interested to hear from you, Andy, particularly with this film and where we were in the world with Ben's kind of want and, you know, idea of making a film in this environment, what your initial kind of thoughts were and what your reaction was as well to the script.
Yeah, I mean, it's an old book. So I think, I mean, we've always done it. It's that weirdly independent thing, isn't it? And I always think of it a bit like music or something, you know, that you just think, well, you know, we want to make this thing. How do we do it? And I think we started because we'd spent years asking people's permission and or asking them for their money to do something. It just got totally had enough. And just, well, okay, well, let's just do it ourselves then, because we just can't. And you know, and you just get to a point where you sort of think, well, we know enough people how to do it. We sort of think we probably could. And then we did it with Down Terrace, and that's how that happened. So the economics of films are such an odd thing, because, you know, they are really, really expensive to make, which means they've got to kind of come back the other way. So, you know, that's my downfall, is I always think about these things as kind of what you want to make or what you like or what you, you know, and it's just, well, this is what we like, let's just try and do it. And then you kind of say, well, why is no one else interested? That's a shame. You know, and I think, but we're always thinking in those terms of like, what, you know, we could just do this or do that. And I think we've got to this point now where, you know, we're not seeking permission to do it. We're just going to try and work out ways to do it. And there's different, you know, parameters, and, you know, with money comes different things. But certainly with this film, we first started, you know, a lot of it was iPhones, wasn't it? Thinking about iPhones and the technology. And again, even with Down Terrace, you know, that film swapped from being something we were seriously thinking about shooting on a VHS camcorder.
Yeah.
Being a proper professional digital camera, because they suddenly existed. And the whole iPhone world was really fascinating. And we were just thinking, well, okay, well, I guess we could do something, you know, and it kind of felt like there was going to be a window of opportunity in the summer where it might be okay to gather a bunch of people and do something. And then obviously, you know, Ben's huge skill is the pragmatism of things. And that's the key, really. It's like, you know, it's just being pragmatic about what you can and can't achieve. And I think we're all, you know, we just do it because we like it and we like the end product of it. And then it's about, you know, it's nice to get paid for doing it, but that's not the only reason, you know. So we just keep working out. So that film literally went from a lot of tests and playing, and you'd been doing it with Nick, haven't you, with the DOP, with Nick Gillespie, about, you know, what you can do with iPhones. And then suddenly it was, you know, we actually weirdly got a phone call from Neon, who I, you know, we sort of know a little bit, saying, kind of effectively, there's no festivals, there's no films we can buy. We think you guys could probably make us a film.
Amazing.
You know, and then I stupidly plucked a number out the air that was obviously up in the air. They said, yeah, sure. I went, oh.
Yeah, they agreed very quickly, you know.
They agreed fast.
Add another 0-1, for Christ's sake.
So it kind of then suddenly became, you know, so, well, actually, we can do this as a proper low-budget movie. It doesn't even have to be an iPhone thing. And it just grew from there. So it's pragmatism, you know. It's always thinking, what have you got? Who will do it? And how do you make it work without compromising the thing?
It looks and feels, and the experience of it is anything but low budget in terms of, you know, it's really funny because we moved out to Gloucestershire like just before the pandemic hit, sort of thing. So I spent a lot of time in forests and woods. But it's amazing how the inspiration that comes from that environment, it comes from nature and comes from also the time that you give yourself to pay attention to stuff.
Yeah, and also that it's different every time you walk through it. I mean, we do a lot of dog walks and stuff through woods, and it's every morning is different. And I think that's really interesting. It doesn't have that kind of wearing you down like the urban experience does. It can look very, very, and also because obviously the seasons and stuff and all the plant life is all changing every other day, is a completely different set of things have popped up.
Yeah.
Terrible Secret of In the Earth is about 10 miles from Henley is where we shot it.
Oh, you hide it well. But because the one thing that you did tell me when we spoke, when you mentioned this in October, was about the whole idea of plants communicating, and that's part of the story. So I was so intrigued to sit and watch it. And obviously you've got Clint's score and the sound design of the film are such, they're characters within it in themselves, you know, and they facilitate so many different needs and moods and tension. So, I mean, there's so many jobs that the sound and the music facilitate. It's extraordinary. And I heard you say that a lot of that was written into the script.
Yeah, I mean, it's right up the front of the script, isn't it? The fact that kind of like half the film is about music making, really. You know, it's almost like a live concert that one of the characters is doing in the woods. So that was part of it. And it had come out of, I guess, it had come out of conversations with Clint and wanting to make something that, you know, when you've got the various elements of it and you're looking at a project, you're thinking, well, you've got this Clint Mansell element of it, and you want to put that right at the front if you can. And also because with Rebecca, we'd done this project, which was a lot about underscore, consciously about underscore. And I wanted to make something that was going the other way. So the music was really in your face, you know. And yeah. So they were the first conversations with Clint, going just like, let's let loose, let's go. You know, you are the sound of the forest, the sound of the plants. You're the sound of Dr. Wendell and all that. And we will mix it right to the top of the movie, you know, and it won't be hiding any of this stuff. I find that a lot. You know, you listen to soundtracks, you really like soundtracks, and then you watch the film, which is obviously the wrong way around of doing it, but then you watch the film and you find that the soundtrack's been mixed to oblivion underneath a load of chat, you know, and this really amazing music has disappeared, and I didn't want that to happen with this. I wanted it to be... And it's the same in the same way that the sound and the sound design by Martin Pavey is right at the front, so is things like the lighting effects and stuff are right. It's written into the script so you can justify showing it, basically.
To what extent, though, are you writing it in the script in terms of the description of it and what it's... Because, like, you know, you've got Hayley's character, you know, she's live DJing to this forest. It's amazing. You know, she's kind of like, whenever I go out and DJ, which doesn't happen very often, obviously, at the minute, but I never plan a set. I always kind of like have a couple of records that I know I'm going to play, but then I'll just take shitloads of stuff from me because I want to sort of feel what they're, you know, what energy. And that's exactly what she's doing almost with this kind of, with this forest. She's kind of like, oh, it's brilliant. I loved that. I'm hoping like with the DVD extras, there's like the kind of extended DJ set from Hayley, like DJing to the trees.
I mean, I really want to do a double bill with the thing, with the film, the other film that Andy had been working on, the Delia Derbyshire.
Oh my God, yes.
And it was weird. It was totally unplanned, but it seems like there's a very strong connection between the two movies, really, you know.
You know, rumour has it she did the Legend of Hell House soundtrack, if you know that, by Delia Derbyshire. That's, I mean,
oh, wow.
That's really incredible.
That
film. And the sounds are, yeah, it was her and Brian Hodgson, although I think disputed as to who did what, but anyway, but it's an amazing 70s kind of haunted house movie that she did the soundtrack to. It was great.
I was thinking of things that I could that for me were references of things. It was everything from like Close Encounters to Doctor Who to kind of nature programs as well. You know, there's sort of everything's kind of in there. And I wondered if you did have any kind of reference points with regards to specifically what you were asking of Clint.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there was a lot of synth in there, and some of that had come from, you know, he was pulling stuff from thinking about Fulci and kind of 70s Italian horror.
Yeah.
But also just from the very, and from Carpenter as well, but from the very core of it, of what it is, like a horror movie with not enough money to go and do, have Clint stuff orchestrated. It was always going to be synth. And that's true to the form of what it is, you know. And what I really like about it is it's directly from Clint's fingers.
Yeah. There's no filter.
There's no filter, and it's him mucking about with and making his own sounds and making all that stuff, and so that was really important, and basically because it goes to the core of horror soundtrack making, you know. And
like the way it's so, you know, the discordant stuff, because you know that he did it with wiring up plants to convert the, you know, the whatever plants do to like to a MIDI signal and then
bioelectrical.
Yeah, put that in a
response. That's amazing. Him and Attenborough together on a show, that's what we need, isn't it?
But he did an amazing job where he combined that kind of pure, you know, analogue chaos with the score, you know, because you wouldn't, it feels like the way it synthesises together is so good, I think. It's really...
Yeah, and he really was, and we basically, I was working with him from, I guess, from around April time. So he'd seen very early versions of the script and we were talking, and because of COVID, we had loads of time to prep. So I was getting demos. He was writing stuff all the time, you know. So we had hours of it early on of trying to find the sounds for it. And then just before we started shooting, just this email came from him with the whole score on it, which we weren't expecting. He didn't tell us. And then it just turned up and went, oh God, there's 45 minutes of stuff here. And so that made a big difference to the shoot. So because I was editing it as I was shooting it, but we were able to put the music on top of each scene as we went along. I mean, he rescored afterwards again.
Yeah.
But the music we had initially was incredible.
Because you've obviously, you know, within the film, we've got these speakers that are kind of wired up to the trees and stuff. And those were you actually playing stuff out of those then? And was it Clint's stuff that he'd sent you?
Yeah. Wow. We're playing a lot of that out when we could, because obviously there's a practicality with it because it ballses up the sound of the actors. But when is there was stuff like when Reese Shearsmith is in all the strobes running around, that was all live music or live Clint music being played in, and I think it was it was pretty cool.
We used this guy he's an amazing guy who's in Finland, and we got him to take all the sound when we were sort of nearly mixed the film. We got him to take the whole soundtrack out into the woods in Finland and re-record it back to give us that sort of, it's kind of fun.
Oh wow, God, I'd like to have gone on that trip. That's amazing. So good.
Well, the thing is with that though, what he does is you speed up the sound and then play it back really fast, but record it at a high bit rate. And then when you play it back at the normal speed, it's then got all this huge atmosphere on top of it. So the recording wouldn't have been much fun. It would just been... You just stood there going...
Really intrigued to see what this film is.
Pound shop water
merchant. Yeah, oldie water merchant, isn't it?
How much, though, do you think that informed how you shot stuff or how you edited, you know, in terms of what the film ended up being, having that in advance?
Well, it gave me a lot of confidence because there's a lot of atmospheric stuff that we were shooting that can look like nothing, you know, like just people walking about. But once you start to put the music on it, you go, oh, wow, I really feel it. But there was a thing where, because we'd taken over a hotel in Maidenhead and...
It's very glamorous. It was on a sort of motorway roundabout.
Yeah. And
love those.
I was talking to Nick Gillespie and he was saying, are we near a flight path? I'm like, no, Nick, I don't think so. And what it was me playing back Clint's music so loud that it was making the whole hotel vibrate. Because I had these huge, what were they? They were like monitor speakers, weren't they? Like studio monitor speakers. And they were so brilliant, these speakers.
Amazing.
The sub bass would just make the whole place vibrate.
Oh, I love that. When you stand... when we used to be allowed to go to gigs and you'd stand right at the front, right by the speaker, and it would like almost vibrate your organs. It's amazing. Yeah. So good. The performances in this are brilliant. Just to come off music for a second, small cast, but man, do they kind of punch you whenever they're on screen. I mean, Reese, obviously, you know, from working with him in the past, and I feel like you give people the opportunity to sort of not show off, but give performances that nobody kind of really kind of gives them an opportunity to do. And Hayley's like the same as well. And I just think that I'd be interested to know if you had them specifically in mind when you were writing the script, or if there was slight sort of, you know, attention to who was going to be in those parts when you were fine-tuning the script.
Reese was always front of mind for it. You know, it's kind of based around that, around him, just because he knows so much about horror that any horror thing he's in, he elevates immediately, you know, so it's kind of that. And I also just like working with him, so I just write him in, you know. And then I think Joel I'd worked with before on Wrong Door. Like, we basically did our first jobs together years ago, which was really weird. I think he'd done one Casualty or something like that, and I'd done a bit of a sketch show, and then we did Wrong Door together. So, and I'd always been thinking about working with him again if I could. So that was great that he was around. And I think as an avatar for my own kind of complete cowardice and incompetence, I think he worked really well, you know. And then Hayley was obviously worked with Hayley before, so again it was like any excuse to work with her. So but she had a particular take on it which we hadn't, you know, and I hadn't thought about, and there was something very Hammer horror Barbara Steele kind of thing that she brought to the whole thing, which was brilliant, you know, which we hadn't.
Her playing the keyboard at the end, she turns around, is so, you know, straight out of a Barbara movie or something. It's great.
Yeah, so it's such a great performance, really.
I can really see, it's funny, when I'm on, you know, on set, I can see Ben enjoying performances. I think you do, don't you?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
That's, you know, that is the you know, cinema's not a script, and it's not, you know, it is the interpretation of stuff by actors, isn't it, ultimately? I mean, that's why I think like things like Dogma films work, you know, because it's ultimately what is important, you know, and the importance is the behind the eyes of what everyone are doing, isn't it? And you can have as much as you like, but ultimately what you're looking at is the eyes of the people saying stuff or whatever, or the performance or what they're doing. And I think that's, you know, that's great fun, just seeing it come alive. And I mean, I remember on things like on Bursted, you know, where you've got Charles Dance and you've got, you know, Mr. Patterson, them together in a room, you just think, this is just amazing. You know, they're so good at what they do.
Well, it's such a treat. It's a treat to, this film was a treat just to get out of the house to start with and to do a bit of work.
To do anything, yeah.
But it was a massive treat to, it's always a massive treat to see. To see people working, and it was stuff like it's Joel's like management of pain.
Yes,
how he played pain across the film. I was like, God, I hadn't even thought about that. How complicated that would be for him to do, you know, because he's got to make sure that it goes up a level each time, and like and show different styles and flavors of it. And I was like, wow, you know. And often it's like a kind of not being an actor for me. It's like a bit of a masterclass in acting whenever we do these jobs, and watching people work is amazing, you know.
Yeah, and the way that he almost kind of like tries to talk himself out of experiencing the pain every time as well, it's so funny. And that's the great thing about the film as well, so it has this kind of brilliant tone. And I think both him and Reese have got this brilliant ability, with Reese in particular in this character, where you just don't know like if he's being ironic, if he's being, you know, it's like the tone is so precise in terms of this character, who he doesn't allow you to read him really at all, because within the space of a sentence, he could flip from one thing to the next sort of thing. It's so good.
Yeah, and it's a different performance again from Reese as well, I think, for my money. And I think that in itself is a minor miracle, seeing as he's burnt through so many performances in Inside Number 9 over the last few years. It's like he's had to do so many different styles, you know.
Yeah.
It's bonkers, really. I mean, I wonder if there'd be actors that would have that many challenges on top of each other so fast, you know. But all the
steeped in it, isn't he? That's what's so incredible. You know, you just know, you kind of, he gets it and he knows exactly what you want it to be and the tone of it. And he's an encyclopedia of all those kind of movies. He knows them way better than we do. And but it's, you just know spot on what he's going to do, you know, which is, that's, to have that confidence in someone is amazing. You know, it makes it so much easier.
Is he based on anyone, Zach?
What, Zach? Character?
Yeah.
No,
Whitehead.
he's not really. No, I mean, you know, as ever, all the characters are usually me. So yeah,
slightly scary. And you know where the door is, yeah. He's even like the his attire, you know, the hair and stuff as well. It's just, which is quite immaculate in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like it's. It's even though he's kind of, you know, it's long and strangly, there's an attention.
Yeah, there's a definite vanity.
There's a vanity there. Absolutely. Yeah.
Quite a tidy tent.
That's the thing as well, is the immersiveness of it when you're in that, and when he's going through all the different sections, pass through the tarpaulins and stuff, and it really, you're kind of going, wait, where are we? It's a real kind of sensual physical experience, because you're there, you're in it, and you're terrified.
That's the instant jello. Just put a couple of a red and a green tarp up.
What was the initial catalyst for writing this script, though, Ben, in terms of like, where did the idea of this story come from?
It came from lots of different places, I guess. I mean, some of it was from reading about the kind of fungal network bits of the that end up in the film and just being amazed by that. And then that tying back to kind of having been through 3 years of like kind of mad politics of people telling all sort of bending truth, basically. And I like that those two things seem to kind of weirdly meld together in my head as I was writing it, and kind of thinking, oh, you know, it's, I think it was like thinking, oh, the plants are so smart and we're so kind of arrogant as humans, and we think we've got it all sorted, and they've got it all sorted. They've already done it all, you know, and it's just beneath their feet the whole time. So that kind of came into it. And then it was like, you know, I wanted to think about horror, because I hadn't made a horror film since, completely straight horror film since Kill List. And I was going back to that and what I felt about the movies I'd made, and kind of how that kind of weird kind of twisting of myth, how that works as entertainment, and how people build myth and tell themselves stories and lies, and you know, and how these things build up as a patina of like on culture, you know. So it was a bit of that going on, but it's like a kind of journey through horror, you know. So they start off as like Hansel and Gretel, and then they kind of end up as into Texas Chainsaw world, and then they end up into kind of 70s British horror Doctor Who, like you say.
Yeah.
Nigel Neal,
yeah, which is another crossover, Survivors and all those kind of
things. Yeah.
That kind of stuff, you know.
I really felt as well that there was a almost kind of like a little, I don't know, a little love letter to all your previous films, just kind of slightly peppered in here as well. Not all of them, but kind of quite a few of them. And not because Reese is in it, but Field in England, there was definitely a kind of, I don't know, a kind of nod into the heart, I guess, basically.
Yeah, well, there is that thing, is like when she goes, when Laura goes into the Alma character goes into the middle of the fog, she's confronted by a mirror, you know, which is so it is a thing, you know. It's like a reflection back on those movies, and also it's just trying to, I think there is a conversation made for me anyway between Field in England and this film, just in terms of still trying to come to terms with Field in England and what the experience of that was, you know, and where that sits. So and to Kill List as well, to a degree.
Yeah. Can't believe Kill List is, what, 11 years old now?
Yeah. We failed.
We totally failed to do the 10-year anniversary.
I mean, it's been kind of hard to really, to be honest. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. In all this, I think. Let's look forward to the 15th, shall we?
Yeah, yeah, 20th or 12th.
Let's just be 13. Let's do 13. Do you know what I mean? It feels right, doesn't it? Andy, I wanted to ask whether this experience of having to shoot a film in the kind of restraints or constraints of a, you know, worldwide pandemic, if it was massively different in terms of producing a film.
I think that the lucky thing is that we've got a whole bunch of people that we've worked with before a lot. There is always a kind of core team of people that kind of know us and we know them, and I think they trust us not to balls it up completely, and that's a very good place to start. And then after that, we, you know, the weirdest thing was because we basically hired a whole hotel. So it was empty. It was an empty hotel. We hired the rooms and we just had to buy the whole hotel out, which was kind of nuts. But we had to buy out when people turned up for coffee. We go, why are these other people here? We're supposed to be in a COVID bubble. Oh, they're just coming in for a coffee. It's like, no, they're not. Anyway.
Would you like to come into the woods?
So that was, on that side, it was very, very, very scary and odd. You know, on day one, it was like, is this going to be a complete disaster? And obviously, you know, it was a low budget film, but it was still a lot of money. And, you know, Neon were fantastic and trusting us to do it, you know, so there is a lot of pressure. And I mean, the pressure points were obviously the testing days when the results come in, you're just thinking, because I think at that point, it was very much like, you know, if anybody tests positive, the whole thing has to shut.
Oh, God, yeah.
Whereas now I think it's, you know, it's much more like, you know, two sort of burly chaps come along and pile them into a van and then they push off and then someone else comes in, you know. So people have kind of got to, as you do, you know, it's like the plastic bags in the supermarket, isn't it? You moan for about 3 months about it. Eventually you actually take a plastic bag. So everyone's, you know, people are kind of managing it, aren't they? You just get used to what it is. And but at that point, you know, it's like, well, there was a lot of pressure on that. But everybody was great. I mean, we sort of said, you know, it was a 3-week shoot and we said, you know, we don't want anyone to go home at all. And it was just like, so it was just shot out in Henley. So most people were in London, or so they could have gone home, but everybody didn't.
Yeah.
We had the whole hotel, you know, so it was as good as we could have it, I think. And everyone was really generous to us to not do it. But then there was no option, obviously. You know, I think it was probably the first new film to be shot.
Yeah,
under
it was.
Those.
Yeah.
You know, and to incorporate that into the storyline as well, though, you know, in a really kind of subtle way, really. It's not a big part of the film at all, but it's obviously, you know, it's going on around the actual narrative.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of why I wrote it, the idea that there'd been such a massive event that changed everything around us that it was bizarre that we were still watching entertainment that didn't have any reference to it.
Yeah.
And as time goes on, it'll be interesting to see how people handle it, whether they will... Because it feels like it's almost a movement never to talk about it again, even while it's happening, you know. And
it's funny, isn't it? Everyone says, "Oh, you know, I've got another boring lockdown pandemic film, or whatever." And it's like, I think, well, fine, yeah, sure, but that doesn't have to be the central tenet of what the film's about.
Yeah,
but the reality is that's where we all are.
Yeah,
at some level, the first day of shooting was the lodge at the beginning, where there's a load of people together. We just didn't know, you know. I mean, you follow the protocols. I think we spent getting on for a quarter of the budget was PPE.
Wow. Which is
a huge amount of money, obviously, in terms of...
That's the way it's got to be now, isn't it?
Really lucky, yeah, and everyone was great and just followed the rules, you know, which was amazing, to be honest.
I found it really interesting, Ben, when you were talking about when you were prepping the film, that you'd looked at, like, the budget, the framework of how Halloween was shot. Is that right? And kind of going, well, look, they did that for this, you know, in terms of looking at the type of budget you were working with and what could be made within that kind of type of budget, you know, with, you know, taking into account inflation and all that kind of boring nonsense. But that's that was kind of a really interesting thing. And I wondered how you got to that film and why it was Halloween you looked at, or were you just going through a number of films to kind of look at the kind of framework of the production and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, Halloween obviously is like one of the main building blocks of horror, or modern horror, for starters. Carpenter's a genius, and I love Carpenter's films as well. But I think it's more that it's the economy of it, and that you can make something that doesn't, you know, I think it's one of the most, it's up there with Blair Witch in terms of budget to profit as well.
Okay.
You know, as an independent movie. So that's why it's important. But it's when you look at it and you start to take it apart and try and work out, you know, physically what they did, and is it possible, you know, when you're making movies at 11 days, 15 days, is it possible to make stuff that looks good? And I think it is, you know. Mm. And certainly I've done stuff in the past where like backwards engineered movies, like I recut Terminator and tried to work out what the coverage that he shot was in Terminator by unediting it and putting it back together in its component parts.
That's amazing. Is this just a hobby?
Yeah. Well, it's my job.
But that's amazing.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you do it because you realise how few shots are in Terminator, but just perfect shots, the right shots, you know. And you know that, and these things that are low budget but look amazing are because whoever's directing it knows exactly what they're shooting, you know. But it was just really encouraging because it's like, it's that... I've had it myself where you kind of make excuses of why you're not doing things. You know, when I was a teenager, like, oh, I can never make a film because I've not got a camera. And then I borrowed a camera off someone. I was like, I can't make films because of some other reason, you know. And it's like, and it's that kind of thing. And but when you see like the, I think Halloween's like 20 days or something like that. So they had a couple more days than us. But it's really, it's efficient, you know, it's quick. And the budget's more the thing, you know. It was the same as ours. But even if you look at Taxi Driver, I think the Taxi Driver budget now is adjusted. I think it's $3 million now.
Wow.
So it's a tiny, tiny budget, yeah.
I watched Escape from New York again recently. I hadn't watched that in years. Oh, man, it was so good. That's what I've loved, is being reminded of great films over the past, not being able to get to the cinema as much and kind of diving back into kind of your DVD collection or, you know, feeling like...
I think I did. I thought, I will watch all of John Carpenter's films. And then I did. And all the ones I hadn't seen. I was like, oh, brilliant. And really enjoyed them all. Even ones that people have been a bit snotty about. I was like, oh, this is great. What are people talking about?
Yeah.
Ghost of Mars? Come on, bring it on. Brilliant.
Ooh, there we go. I'm going to watch that one tonight. I haven't done that one either. I'm going to let you guys go. But Andy, thank you so much for joining us. It's always just brilliant to get to. So nice to get to kind of peel back the curtain a bit as well, to sort of, you know, that side of the world and being a producer. But having you both on is absolutely brilliant. And I am so flipping excited about Meg 2 as well. I know you're starting that in January. It's so exciting that you're doing it. And I can't wait to see what you do with it. That's what I love about you, Ben. One of the many things is just how much a fan of filmmaking you are and just of storytelling, you know, whether you're going around there, making stuff in the States and getting excited about where Psycho was shot, where you're shooting and all. Do you know what I mean? Just the genuine passion and love that you have for stuff. And I know that that's going to be poured into this film as well.
It's really exciting and bonkers, and like the idea you can draw something and then they'll actually build it massive and then blow it up.
My god, it's like being a child. It's the best thing ever.
That's my life.
Brilliant. Well, listen, I hope you'll come back for a sixth sitting then, because Meg 2 feels like a brilliant opportunity to do that. And Andy, we need to get you on your own as well to dive into your amazing collection of work. We're not that scary, are we?
No, it's a gentle move in, perhaps.
Yeah. Listen, congratulations on In the Earth. It's brilliant. I really enjoyed it, and thanks for giving me such a great experience at the cinema. And I hope to see you both soon.
Yeah, you too.
Bye, gents. See ya. Bye. From the score to In the Earth, That's the Woods by Clint Mansell, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Ben Wheatley and Andy Stark. My huge thanks to Ben and Andy for taking the time to talk to us on our fifth birthday. Here's to the next 5 years. Woohoo! In the Earth is available to watch on digital formats now, with Clint's incredible score available via our good friends at Invader Records. Big shout out to the Invader Records team as well for all their support over the last 5 years. And hopefully we can continue that brilliant working relationship in the future. Now, if you want to hear my previous chats with Ben and Clint, you can head to edithbowman.com, where you'll be able to subscribe and search for all of our previous episodes. And you can do that via film, director, just name. It's all up there. So edithbowman.com. Please also follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please do tell your friends about us if you like what you hear, because we really rely on word of mouth and your reviews and your ratings and all that kind of thing. Because as I said, we're a two-man team and we don't have, you know, big budgets and marketing teams behind us. So if you like what you hear, please do spread the word. Also, we have a little YouTube channel up called Soundtracking Extra. It'd be great if you could go and check that out and subscribe to it. And what I've put up this week is the entire unedited conversation visually with the Loki director Kate Herron and composer Natalie Holt. So head to our YouTube page to check that out and see Kate and Natalie talk about their incredible work on the Loki series. Next up, a man we've been trying to get on the show for quite a while actually, and I know some of you will have been along to see James Gunn's version of Suicide Squad. If you listen to James Gunn's episode of this podcast, you'll have heard him talk about working with the brilliant Tyler Bates across the Guardians of the Galaxy films. Also, Chad Stahelski and Keanu Reeves talking about working with Tyler Bates on the John Wick films. And I am absolutely thrilled that we are joined by Tyler Bates on the show next week. He is a man who obviously has a massive music career, working with the likes of Bush and Marilyn Manson and various others. But his film and TV and video game soundtrack are pretty impressive as well. So make sure you join us. Tyler Bates is our guest on next week's show. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.